All eyes are on Oregon and on the calendar. In 6 days, marijuana for personal recreational use goes legal in Oregon. But Oregon's been dealing with marijuana as medicine for years now and still clearly has some bumps and bugs to work out. A recent example, a report in the Oregonian, Oregon Live Online, detailing the presence of pesticides in medical marijuana. And it's more than just finding the pesticides. The report also detailed lax state regulations on pesticides and tests by laboratories that missed substances that other labs found. We have the Oregonian reporter and a lab that got it right. Noelle Crombie is the reporter. Noelle, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And Roger Volker's here as well. He's the lab director at OG Analytical, Oregon Growers Analytical, based in Eugene. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. So, Noelle, never a dull moment on this beat. I just ran across a promo picture in the paper yesterday with showing you and explaining that you are the marijuana person. Is this all you cover?
It is. It's been my beat since 2012.
And how busy are you at any given time?
You know, it's been a really steady beat. I think it's probably the best beat in American journalism today. The cannabis beat sits sort of at the cross-section of politics and pop culture, public health, science. There's lots of directions you can take this beat, and that's what makes it pretty rich and fertile ground, particularly in a state like Oregon with such a well-established and robust cannabis culture.
You know, it appears from where we sit that there's quite a flurry of activity as July 1st approaches. Is that certainly true for you and your beat?
Yeah, it's been very busy, and I think that you know, the public has a lot of questions about what July 1st means. And so as soon as I, you know, basically hit publish on that pesticide report, we really pivoted to July 1. It's a milestone date for Oregon. And, you know, we really want to let readers know what it means for them. I mean, what it means in terms of personal possession and home cultivation, what you can and what you can't do. People have written in and called me with all kinds of scenarios, you know, their personal situations, both, you know, their, you know, can they smoke in a rental apartment? What does this mean for employment? How do they obtain marijuana, both plants and in usable form? And so I've been, you know, sort of trying to answer as many questions as I can.
I imagine you probably have the fullest email box of any reporter at the Oregonian these days.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Roger Volker, we notice you have a molecular biology degree from the University of Oregon and experience working in the pesticide residue lab at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Can we assume from the molecular biology degree that this work gets very detailed?
I'm sorry. I don't quite understand.
Well, in other words, I mean, if we're talking about molecular biology, we're really getting into the really way down in there in the details of what it is that you're running tests on.
Yeah, I mean, my background was originally analytical chemistry, and then I transitioned into sort of biochemistry / molecular biology, and then I actually took advantage of the sort of analytical training when I got the job at the Department of Ag, and I sort of went back to molecular biology and computational biology, and then now I'm back in analytical chemistry. So I've kind of kept my feet in actually a number of disciplines right now.
Tell us about the kind of work you do at OG Analytical.
Well, I mean, our primary motivation, our primary motive is basically testing for, you know, testing cannabis products so that they're, to make sure that they're compliant with the current rules. In addition, we do have some other, you know, we do some work for other clients, non-cannabis clients, but the primary work that we do is related to the, you know, cannabis sold in Oregon.
And so the growers bring stuff to you and say, hey, check this out, make sure it's okay?
Well, it's a combination. You know, we have a lot of dispensary clients, but then we also have a lot of growers and, you know, extract producers or medible producers, et cetera.
And so, Noelle, tell us about the spark that led to the piece on pesticides and medical pot.
You know, I think it was in early, early last year, sometime early in the year. I was interested in doing something around testing, and this was as the state was launching its regulated dispensary program. Part of those regulations required that medical marijuana that's sold to these regulated outlets undergo testing for mold and mildew, potency, and pesticides. And I sat through all that, the rulemaking around those requirements, and I went back to my editors and proposed that we do something, look at this issue of testing. I had noticed kind of this emergence of a cottage industry of labs. These labs fall outside of the regulatory framework of the state. I wondered, what kind of information they were generating, what was happening in these labs. So I didn't have a great sort of idea of what that story would be, but I sort of floated the idea with editors here. What did they think? Could we test cannabis? And, that's a pretty complicated, that's new ground for newspapers. And I'd say they were cautiously supportive of the idea. And as the year went on, and I, continued to sort of press this idea, there was enthusiasm around it. Mark Ketches, who's the editor of the Oregonian and has a strong investigative journalism background, came to the paper last summer, and when I mentioned this to him in my first one-on-one meeting with him, he was really supportive and wanted to move ahead with a story that looked at testing. And so we went through this process of having an Oregonian staff member obtain a medical marijuana card. This staff member has a qualifying condition, and there was a lot of discussion around this. This was a really well considered plan.
You wanted to be ethically clean on this, yeah.
Yeah. We discussed this with leaders in ethics and journalism nationally. We had a lot of hard discussions around this at the paper. And so, but we moved ahead with getting this person certified under the medical marijuana program. And then we decided to look at edibles first.
Okay, we'll pick it up there on the other side of a break from edibles. Noel Crombie from the Oregonian is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, along with Roger Volker from Oregon Growers Analytical in Eugene, a lab director there. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking today about pesticides in medical marijuana in Oregon, uncovered by an Oregonian investigation, Oregon Live Online. Noel Crombie is the reporter from the Oregonian joining us on the exchange. Roger Volker is the lab director at OG Analytical, Oregon Growers Analytical, based in Eugene, which helped out in the process of figuring out what was in the stuff that was submitted. The key phrase in the article is a combination of lax state rules, inconsistent lab practices, and inaccurate test results has allowed pesticide-laced products to enter the medical marijuana market. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. So we were talking about still an interesting process. It's not like every day a journalistic organization decides to go out and buy marijuana, even where it is legal. So here you got a card for somebody at the Oregonian, Oregon Live. They did have a condition, and then you said you went for edibles first?
Yeah, we decided to start there. It seemed like an accessible entry point into this testing issue. And so we bought edibles, and I worked to try and identify a lab that could help us with this process. And in calling around to scientists that I know on the beat, I kept hearing about Roger Volker at OGA, and so I talked to Roger about this, testing the edibles, and he was willing to do it. So we sort of commissioned this look at potency, and essentially is the potency of the product, does it match what the label claims? And we found that in many cases it does not. Interestingly, there was a report out of the Journal of American Medicine this week by Johns Hopkins researchers who found similar findings when it came to potency of edible products and how they're often, you know, the claims are inaccurate on the labels. But we spent a lot of time at Rogers Lab while working on this edibles project, and at one point I noticed I noticed a couple of things. He's a very meticulous scientist. He takes a lot of care to be accurate, and I appreciate that as a journalist. And I noticed that he had this these plastic bins near his lab bench of plastic containers of hash oil. And at one point during one of my reporting trips there, I asked, you know, what's up with these? What's in these bins? And he said, oh, that's, you know, that's all contaminated with pesticides. And so that was shocking, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And you know, it turned out this was alarming to Roger enough so that he had been documenting this problem or this what he noticed as a pattern and had his own data around that. And I'll let him speak to that now. I mean, it's very compelling, and it was really the basis of, you know, it formed the basis of why we decided to take a hard look at this.
Go ahead, Roger.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, this kind of goes back, clear back to 2013. At that time, I was working at the University of Oregon, and through a series of, you know, friends I had at, you know, that I, colleagues at the university, at this time, you know, I was aware of this, you know, upcoming set of rules about marijuana and stuff. And again, I had no connection to this industry whatsoever. I was just simply working at the university, but I had worked in a regulatory lab. And through a friend, basically, I was put in contact with Bethany Sherman at the time. And so I began this discussion. I met with her, and she had this interest in, you know, she wanted to know more about testing for pesticides and the potential of starting a lab. And so I met with her and, you know, talked about the challenges of that and what it would cost, et cetera. But, and then I basically, you know, agreed to sort of do consulting work for a period of time. And during that time, you know, I felt like one of the most important things for us to do in terms of the rules was to, you know, we had to understand what kind of pesticides were being used, you know, what kind of use rates, et cetera, et cetera. And there really wasn't any information. And so I spent a great deal of time looking into that. And this included information, you know, talking with growers and Matthew Combs at OG Analytical went out and surveyed grow shops, and so we got an idea of the compounds. And I studied a lot of other public databases. And so I had an idea of kind of what compounds to look for. I mean, first of all, we have to keep in mind there's over 3,000 compounds that are classified as pesticides.
Really, that many? 3,000? Okay.
And so the biggest challenge with setting a rules with regards to pesticide testing is, first of all, limiting that list down to a manageable list. And so we were doing work on that, on, you know, completely independent of the state or anything, because we had no connection with the rulemaking process at that time. Well, anyway, in December, December to February, the rules were basically finalized, and I was very disheartened when the rules finally came out, because the few statements in there about pesticides were seriously problematic in the language. I understand that, you know, the motivation, I think, was definitely good, but the language in the rule was clearly problematic. And we actually wrote a document and submitted that to the Oregon Health Authority, but never heard anything back, where I outlined some of the problems. And, in fact, all of those problems have pretty much come to fruition now. So when I signed on to actually, I joined OG Analytical, it became very clear to me that in order to make appropriate rules, we had to have data. The state of Oregon was not going to gather that data. Nobody else seemed to have that data. And so we took it upon ourselves to gather that data. And so we, at our own expense, started to look for additional compounds that were outside of the list, the current rules, but for compounds for which we had suspicion were being used, et cetera. And then we basically, again, started to gather data. And, you know, and my goal with that was simply to do what's happened now, is to make data available to rulemakers so that we can actually have an appropriate conversation about this issue so we can put in place appropriate rules.
So we're talking to Roger Volker from, he's the lab director at OG Analytical in Eugene. Noel Crombie's the reporter with the Oregonian who did the piece on pesticides and pot. So, Noel, can I sum this up for the folks who are just tuning in, that there is stuff used on marijuana that is not highly advertised. There is not a great list of what to look for, and it is being missed when it is looked for.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally that's true. I think that the consumer makes a series of assumptions when they walk into a dispensary. They feel that this is a safer option than purchasing from someone maybe they don't know, and that it's been tested. And of course, they would assume that because, you know, it's on the label. The pesticide results are often, you know, on the label with, you know, the lab name, the tracking number, or some kind of tracking number or batch sample number. And then if you ask for a lab certificate for that product, the dispensary, we found that dispensaries were generally happy to share that information. And so the consumer leaves with this understanding that this product meets state standards. You know, most don't know what those standards are, but they assume that they're, you know, protecting the patient's health, and the product is free of contaminants. Many of the products in these shops are labeled as organic or marketed as organic because the grower, I mean, there are no rules around how to market, you know, to use the term organic in cannabis, but often growers feel that, you know, they're only using products that are approved for use in organic agriculture, and so that they should be able to use that as a marketing tool, and they do. And, you know, we found products that were labeled organic that had pesticides that are covered by the rules and should have kept them off the shelves. You know, I think there's a couple of issues that Roger, you know, mentioned. You know, we've got state rules that are very broad when it comes to pesticides. You know, the state has outlined these four very broad categories of pesticides that labs should look for. But as Roger said, those categories have many, many pesticides in them, and labs are left on their own to decide which of those pesticides to look for. And some, you know, we talked to one lab owner who stopped testing for one pesticide because he was finding it too often and having to fail products and wasn't seeing those customers back at his lab. And so it's so that's problematic. And then there are pesticides that growers are using that are not covered by those rules. And so we found instances of that. I think, too, growers in Oregon they're not told what they can use. The state hasn't really done any kind of outreach or established any kind of guidelines on what pesticides growers should be able to use. You know, this is an issue that's very complicated for states because states typically don't really set pesticide policy. They take their leads from the federal government, and the federal government hasn't really weighed in on cannabis and pesticides. And so,
because it's still legal at the federal level.
Yes, and cannabis is not included on any pesticide label. And in pesticides, in the world of pesticides, you know, the label is the law, and no pesticide includes cannabis as an accepted, you know, as an acceptable crop for use for that product. And so states are kind of having to, you know, make up rules on their own here in this kind of vacuum. And Oregon really didn't do a whole lot of research on, you know, what are growers using in the state when it came up with the rules that are currently in place.
Roger, you mentioned sending a letter to the Oregon Health Authority. Is the OHA the primary agency responsible for regulations, or is it the Oregon Department of Agriculture, or a mix?
Well, the current under the current program we're operating under with the medical marijuana program, yeah, OHA is the agency. And, you know, but in reality, the Department of Agriculture is the entity within the state that actually has the authority over pesticides, but they are currently not engaged in this particular market. And so, again, that is definitely one of the problems.
Pesticides and marijuana, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Roger Volker is the lab director at OG Analytical in Eugene. Noel Crombie is the reporter at the Oregonian who did the piece that uncovered a lot of this. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Bree in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me, and thank you for having your guests on. I think this is a really important topic. I'm the person responsible for the Breeze Botanicals in Gold Hill and Ashland, and you know, I've always viewed myself as the gatekeeper. You know, I come from an herbalism background, and it's kind of my job to make sure that whatever comes in the back door as far as excess medicine from patients is going to be safe for my patients to consume. You know, we implemented pretty strict organic growing standards for purchasing here, and we use kind of the USDA policy to base that on. But it was very, very hard for me to find labs that I felt comfortable working with because, as your listeners and your guests know, they're not currently regulated. So I guess my question is specifically for your chemist. I have concerns about cannabis oils, even though they may have been grown organically, that they're put in these e-cigarette cartridges, and if your chemist has noticed any problems with the high heat that's applied from the batteries of people vaporizing those cannabis oils and that getting into their lungs, if there's any residual solvents or issues there from the cartridges.
Okay, a very detailed question. Thanks for that, Bree. Appreciate it. And Bree, by the way, will be part of our piece run from OPB on next Tuesday's exchange at 9 o'clock. Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, Bree, that's a good question. There's a lot of pertinent issues here. So first of all, with regards to, you know, vaping, there was a really nice study done. It was a peer-reviewed study done, published a number of years back by Jeff Raber, who runs the workshop down in California as a cannabis testing lab. And they demonstrated that basically pesticides, the significant proportion of pesticides that are present in the oils actually survive the vaping process, and so it isn't like they're broken down or they disappear during that process. But then another component is that, like, if you're heating it, there is a concern that, again, a lot of pesticides can survive that. And think about it, it's not that surprising because THC survives that process, and so a lot of pesticides survive that. But in addition to that, just like with cigarettes, when you're burning it, there's also pyrolysis, which produces some particularly nasty compounds. Now, I've never looked at that directly. I'm not aware of anybody who has yet. But then with regards, you also mentioned something about residual solvents, and that is another concern. And the current rulemaking process is actually going to be addressing this concern about residual solvents. And most of the other states that have really taken this on have implemented rules for residual solvents, and I think the same is going to happen in Oregon.
All right, so let's go way, way back to Bree mentioned this, but it's something you mentioned very earlier in the conversation, Noel, about the labs are generally outside the regulatory framework of the state. What is the current picture on lab regulation?
Well, you know, this committee, you know, the rules for House Bill 3460, which is a dispensary law, had this, you know, testing requirement, and, you know, I think there were a couple of labs early on, but really that requirement, I think, fueled this this nascent testing industry. And, you know, we don't really know a whole lot about that industry, how it operates right now. I mean, I think we will now that the Oregon legislature is sort of moving forward with a provision that would require that these labs be certified and operate under some standards. But for now, they don't operate under those standards, and it's so it's unclear, you know, who works there, how many there are. I mean, the Oregon Health Authority does not know how many labs there are operating in the state. And these are labs that are essentially certifying the safety of these products that you find when you walk into a medical marijuana dispensary. These dispensaries are establishments serving people who are, you know, vulnerable and ill. And they are counting on this, you know, the lab is essentially acting as this safeguard on this check on these products. And, you know, they operate with various levels of expertise, wide differences in equipment, as I said, they can really pick and choose what it is they're looking for. And this is a really competitive market, and labs that fail samples are at risk of not seeing those growers or dispensaries come back. And so it's not, you know, as one lab owner told me during my reporting on pesticides, he wished he had the patients back, but he really doesn't. That the rules do not create a level playing field right now. And so it's sort of every lab for itself. I don't know if Roger can speak to that from the lab perspective, but
it sounds like lab shopping. I want to pick that up on the other side of a break. We're talking to Roger Volker and Noel Crombie about medical marijuana and pesticides in Oregon. Noel reported on it in the Oregonian and Oregon Live. Roger's the lab director at OG Analytical in Eugene. We'll come back and talk more with them. We have some phone calls waiting. We'll talk to you and come back to the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about medical marijuana in Oregon and pesticides showing up in pot samples. Noel Crombie at the Oregonian put together a series of reports about this, both for the paper and for the Oregon Live website, and found a combination of lax state rules, inconsistent lab practices, and inaccurate test results has allowed pesticide-laced products to enter the medical marijuana market. That's the key phrase from Noel's work. She's been working with Roger Volker, lab director at OG Analytical, Oregon Growers Analytical. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just getting to this issue of what appears to be lab shopping, where if a grower gets a pesticide positive on a sample from one lab, they generally won't come back to that lab. And we're just starting to turn this to Roger to talk about this concept of lab regulation and lab shopping.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't have any direct evidence that people do lab shopping. However, I have anecdotal evidence in that I've had a number of clients who have admitted as much. But the simple fact is that opportunity exists. And what's related to that is the simple fact that, again, labs are not accredited. We don't have, there's no oversight or accreditation, so there's no requirement that, I mean, there's no way of knowing whether or not labs are performing consistently, you know, relative to each other, and that's a real fundamental problem.
Sure.
And, you know, with that regard, I'd like to turn, you know, sort of attention to the sort of the general public. We've got to understand, why doesn't this happen in other arenas of commodities? For instance, you can go to any municipality and turn on the drinking water or turn on your water and drink it and assume that it's safe. And it actually is arguably very safe and uniform across the country. And that's the same with fruits and vegetables that you buy, et cetera. And the reality is that I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is that there's this really large regulatory structure that's in place that ensures that it is there to assure the safety of things that we put in our bodies. And okay, fundamental part of that is, you know, there are numerous labs around the country that test, you know, drinking water and food, et cetera. And the reason that we don't have this problem in other commodities is simply because, again, the labs are subject to oversight by regulatory authorities. They have to be accredited through third party. They have to participate in check samples like proficiency tests. So the labs basically have, you know, there's a guarantee that the labs are actually operating in an appropriate fashion, and that is completely lacking here.
Is that because of the fact that there is no federal regulatory regime because marijuana is still illegal at the federal level?
Well, I think that's definitely part of it. And because, again, normally all of this is done at the federal level because, again, with the other commodities, you know, because they can be sold across state lines, I think it's really considered under the jurisdiction of the federal government. So in this case, you know, the states are left to deal with this all by themselves. And, you know, we don't, generally states, I don't think, have these structures in place to handle such a this complex problem. And, you know, quite honestly, I think that people, you know, within the state agencies probably, you know, they understand it's a problem and they want to do it right, but they actually have no authority to do anything themselves until the legislature gives them that authority. And, you know, quite honestly, this state is sort of, you know, we're not exactly rich.
No, that is for sure. I want to give a special mention, Noel, to Teresa Mahoney for an animated version of this story with a terrific video done with construction paper and things like that, also available on the Oregon Live website. It really kind of boils things down to its simplicity, one of which I want to get to now, which is you brought 10 samples to the labs, and how many of those showed pesticides?
We brought 10 samples, and only two had no pesticides detected. And, you know, and it's important to mention here that, you know, we didn't just rely on Roger. We had another lab, Pacific Agricultural Lab, which is, you know, it tests fruits and vegetables and commodities. It's a Portland area lab. These guys have long experience in residual pesticide testing. I approached them about working with us on this project, and we had Roger test all 10 of the samples, and then those samples on which he found residual pesticides that both fell under the state rules and at levels that the state doesn't allow, so essentially products that shouldn't have been sold, we had we asked Pacific Agricultural Lab to do its own testing on those products. They did not know what Roger found, so this is a blind analysis, and they happened to confirm his findings and, in fact, found additional pesticides in those products. It's pretty compelling. In other words, you know, Roger had his data that he had, and we sort of tested that by buying our own just random samples, you know, random samples of hash oils, and his findings sort of held up. We found, you know, widespread contamination.
All right. So here again, 8 of the 10 samples showed something.
Yeah. Right, and 3 should not have been sold. 3 had been tested by labs. They had lab, you know, certifications that, you know, when we asked for them at the shops, we were given certificates from the labs saying this product had, you know, no detectable pesticide, or it had a pass next to the pesticide on the lab certificate, and that information was also documented on the labels themselves. And in those 3 cases, they contained pesticides that should have disqualified them from being sold.
All right, got a couple more calls to take here. Bill in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Noel Crombie and Roger Volker.
Yeah, good morning. Kudos to the Oregonian. I read it daily, of course. I've been for years. Oregonian is really performing a wonderful educational function here for the consuming public. I think they're as important an educational organization as Jefferson Public Radio. So anyhow, good going, guys. It illustrates, of course, that I happen to think that marijuana is a harmful substance, even without the pesticides, but many of my organic friends don't think so. They think it's a natural product, mm-hmm. and this is something that they should they should listen to carefully. I'd like to see you spread this information all over the state. I can't thank you enough for talking about this.
Hey, Bill, thanks for checking in on that. And so that brings up the question then, Noel. I mean, you've got this information in hand. You've gone back to the labs. You've no doubt gone to regulators and the state legislature. And so let's hear first the response from labs and dispensaries.
This story, I think, came as a surprise to a lot of people, patients in particular, dispensary owners who spend a lot of money on testing. There was a dispensary in Portland that knew of the work we were doing and went out prior to the publication of our story, pulled 7 hash oils off its shelf and had Roger test them, and some of them failed. And these are products that this dispensary had already paid to have tested. And so I think the manufacturers who we've, included in this report, they have taken a hard look at their own production process and are doing more, trying to put more checks into place on the growers that they work with. We focused in this report on marijuana concentrates because as Roger's work has found, these tend to be more contaminated than flower. And so, the hash oil producers we met with, they're getting trim from lots of growers, and it's often, sort of taking the grower at their word about what they put on the product, plant, and then they count on the lab to sort of check that to make sure that it's clean. And so the producers we spoke with were really, they said they were shocked. One manufacturer has slowed down production and is putting into place good practices, what they described as, best practices. They're trying to have growers fill out forms that are very detailed about what they apply to the plants. But, again, those growers are still just relying on their own, know-how and experience and other growers. It's not like Colorado and Washington, where the states have clearly said, this is what you can use and this is what you can't use. We don't have those kind of guidelines or parameters in Oregon. And so it's up to the grower to essentially, read the label, do their own research. And I think the growers I've spoken with say that, they're doing that more. They're trying to be more discerning about the people that they work with. And I think, I don't know if Roger can talk about this a little, but, the concentrate market is a popular, it's a very fast-growing element of the retail market in Oregon, and these are really popular products, and they tend to be more contaminated, as Roger's work has shown. I don't know if that's something he can address. I think that was alarming to a lot of patients I spoke with.
Roger, can you pick that up?
So this is a really important component of sort of an issue. So basically, we have to look at it. The concentrates. So what we discovered is that the process of making a concentrate, it concentrates not only the THC, but it also concentrates pesticides. And I think that a lot of people were surprised by that, but quite honestly, that actually makes a lot of sense chemically, because again, many of the pesticides are actually, they have similar solubilities as THC, and so I would expect them to come along for the ride. And so that process concentrates the pesticide just like it concentrates the THC. But also, I want to make very clear, it isn't like the concentrates themselves, like something in the making the concentrates produces the pesticides or something like that. It goes back to the source material. It goes back to that there was some flower or trim material that was used that for which a pesticide application had been made. And so it goes all the way back to, the practices that are in place right now with the application of pesticides to cannabis.
Let's take another call. Here's Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to The Exchange with Roger Volker and Noel Crombie.
Thank you again, Jeffrey. One doesn't grow from seed anymore because it's just inefficient. You have to throw away half your plants. So one buys clones, and if you've got an 18-ounce cup with soil in it and the clone growing in it, if that has been treated with pesticide, how much time does it take, or can you dilute or get rid of the pesticide in the soil in your clone? How much is that going to be able to affect the plant at its later stages of growth?
Okay, so pesticide longevity. Interesting question. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Roger?
Yeah, well, I'll take a stab at this. First of all, see, there is unfortunately no real studies done to answer this question. However, we worked with a number of people where, you know, we detected pesticides on their plants, on the flowers, and they said they hadn't applied these products, and I believed them because of, you know, our long relationship. And so we looked into that a little more closely and discovered that, in fact, you know, they were purchased as clones, and we also had information that suggested that the producer of the clones were using, in particular, one compound called imidacloprid. And then we also had some information about Eagle 20 or Michael Butanil. And so basically the information certainly suggests that, and it's consistent with these pesticides, some of these compounds have very long lives. And so I am afraid at this point that application of certain pesticides, some of these compounds, like I just mentioned, two clones, that it will survive throughout the life of the plant and still be detectable in the flower.
Okay.
Now, again, somebody needs to do real data or real research on this before we can really answer that question.
And so ultimately, Noel, do we get to a point where the legislators are taking notice of what you're reporting turned up and thinking maybe it's time for some additional changes to Oregon medical marijuana law?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. As I said, this bill is calling for, more oversight of labs, but I think that it's really the nitty-gritty rulemaking process is where these issues are going to be addressed. The rules are where these technical issues get addressed, and we'll have to see what happens with the OLCC and the Department of Ag.
Mm-hmm. And clearly can be some fairly tricky technical issues, but wonderful reporting. Noel Crombie is the Marijuana Beat reporter for the Oregonian and OregonLive.com. Roger Volker, the lab director at OG Analytical in Eugene. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.